Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root this mountain down. Wish I was a mole in the ground.
Metropolis, a place where success is a weapon of war. Some people live in spectacular mansions. Some people can't afford to live anywhere anymore. But Bezos has the money. He's got all of that money, more than $100 billion in his pants, way down. They built a shiny new temple to themselves downtown. People genuflect as they pass. Artificial sunlight and climate control, so they can colonize a jungle behind a pane of glass. And because Bezos has the money, he's got all of that money, clutching in the fingers of his hand. He's a rich man.
Good morning. That was Eric Bibb singing the Old Mole song and Jim Page singing Amazon, a song that pretty well encompasses inequality today in a nutshell. People dying on the streets while a handful of deeply unhappy billionaires race each other to colonize the moon. This is Desiree Helgers, and I'll be your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, anti-colonial point of view. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. On today's show, first off, Teaching Palestine. In their introduction to Teaching Palestine, Lessons, Stories, Voices, the editors begin by noting the silencing they routinely encounter. Quote, Israel and Palestine is just too complicated to teach, unquote. Both liberal and conservative commentators often caution. The book unfolds as a potent counter to that silencing. Over 20 contributions from a wide range of disciplines show how the study of Palestinians' history, struggles, and aspirations can deepen students' critical thinking and understanding of their own society, as well as global politics. Jan Hocken talks with Bill Bigelow and Samia Shoman, two of the editors and contributors, about how this book project developed and how it's been embraced by many teachers and students in spite of the silencing campaigns. And then Kasama Farm. The Municipal Eco-Resiliency Project, or MERP, interviews Jalila and Leilani about Kasama Farm, which specializes in culturally significant crops for the Filipino community in Portland. We feature excerpts from the interview, which also explores topics such as farming during climate change and the rights of farm workers. This interview is part of MERP's Food Sovereignty Media Series and was made possible by a grant from the Mount Hood Cable Regulatory Commission. And finally, What's Cuckoo? Make America Healthy Again in the Fiction of Gretchen Felker Martin. Fran Michelle considers some ideas of the new head of Health and Human Services and recommends the horror novels Manhunt from 2022 and Cuckoo from 2024 by trans writer Gretchen Felker Martin. And we start off with Jan Hocken and Teaching Palestine.
This is Jan Hocken talking today with Bill Bigelow and Samia Shoman, editors and contributors to Teaching Palestine, Lessons, Stories, Voices, a book released last month through Rethinking Schools. Bill Bigelow taught high school for many years here in Portland and is the curriculum editor of the Rethinking Schools magazine, co-directs the Zen Education Project and is author of many books and articles on social justice movements and teaching. Samia Shoman is a Palestinian-American educator. She lectures in the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Program at San Francisco State College of Ethnic Studies and is co-coordinator of the Middle East Children's Alliance Teach Palestine Project. Well, welcome to KBOO on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Bill and Samia.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
Well, and congratulations on this wonderful new book. It's beautifully written and a gripping read, even for those who are not bringing these materials to the classroom. Let's start with how you brought the 20 or so contributors for this project onto Teaching Palestine. Can you give us some background? Samia, would you start?
I actually was going to tell Bill to start because they initiated, but I think it was us really trying to brainstorm creating a book or a resource that would have a breadth of resources for educators. We know some people are in the classroom. We know some people are on special assignment supporting teachers in the classroom. There are administrators, really families that want resources to be able to use to teach their kids at home. So it was kind of, what do we need? What is already available that should be compiled into one place? That was a great starting point. A lot of us had already done work, especially all of the editors on the book, and then relying on people we knew to kind of reach out and see if they would either create pieces or if we can use pieces that were already created.
The five of us again came together in Portland in July of this last year. And so there was Samia, there was Jesse Hagopian, who's also a Rethinking Schools editor and works with the Zen Education Project from Seattle. Adam Sanchez, who is the managing editor of Rethinking Schools from Philadelphia. And then Susanna Kasouf, who teaches here in Portland at Grant High School. And the cool thing was, so we brainstormed, we kind of outlined the book and created a wish list of people that we wanted to reach out to and people's poems that we hope to use, people's short narratives. And what was so gratifying was how many people were just, you know, they just wanted to touch this project. They just immediately said, yes, I want to do this. Naomi Shihab Nye, the wonderful Palestinian poet, you know, she said, absolutely, use whatever I have that you want. She gave us emails from other poets. And so we just began to piece together this kind of assembly of Palestinian voices.
And of course, there's something old and something new in taking up contested topics in the classroom, particularly social justice movements and people that have been marginalized or demonized or ignored for a very long period of time. What was old and what was new with this topic that, of course, you acknowledge in the introduction that people often say it's too complicated to teach about Israel and Palestine? So what did you bring from what you've already experienced and what felt new here for you both?
I think, you know, people have developed new pedagogies for teaching, you know, about Palestine over the years and really have developed kind of nuanced ways. I think it used to be seen as something you teach in social science or history class, and now it is seen as something you can teach. So something new is like taking up, it can be taught in English, it can be taught in science. There are math topics that you can take up. It can be very interdisciplinary. And then of course the genocide in Gaza is something new, and there are lessons and strategies for how you bring that in the classroom, because obviously as Palestine has always been controversial or, you know, hotly contested, that has added, you know, more to it. So I would start with that.
Yeah, you know, Jan, great question. For me, the something old, I guess, is my commitment to work around Palestine solidarity, that I first went to Palestine in 1989 during the first Intifada. And it was on an educator's delegation to East Jerusalem and the West Bank and Gaza in the Jabalia refugee camp. And so, you know, it's one thing to read Edward Said's, you know, The Question of Palestine, and to kind of have an intellectual kind of connection to the occupation and what's gone on. It's something really entirely different to be there and to experience that and to you know, to watch the troop carriers go through Gaza and to have the kid bring us the rubber bullets that had been shot into their school from the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force. So that's sort of an, I guess, an old thing for me, just kind of a longtime commitment. New, you know, I developed a bunch of new curriculum. Susanna Kasuf invited me to come into her classroom at Grant. And so we developed a bunch of new curriculum. And obviously the commitment was, you know, we had to do something about, you know, the genocide in Gaza. And it would be educational malpractice to not, you know, for a social studies teacher to not try and equip kids to understand something about what's going on. And so that was the new, that was the trying to create new curriculum and bring it to the classroom.
Here, I think it was last spring and into the summer, Portland Association of Teachers was under heavy criticism by the local press for bringing this to the classroom and supporting teachers around activism. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Bill, but I'd also like to know if, Sammy, have you had any similar experience in California with criticisms and both the role of the union, teachers unions in supporting teachers, and how this maybe other ways of protecting and supporting teachers.
In California, yes, there's been a lot happening, including, you know, if you go back a few years ago, California decided to adopt a model ethnic studies curriculum. I was actually part of the group that helped draft that curriculum. And there was heavy criticism on what was drafted because it did include Palestine. It did include people like Edward Said, Linda Sarsour, in small little pockets of, you know, lessons or as examples. There was a huge Zionist backlash against that draft. Palestine was essentially wiped out. And the new draft only included these lessons kind of in the appendix, and they were more around Arab American experience. And really the criticism was around the inclusion, you know, of Palestine. That kind of set off, right, this big controversy in California around ethnic studies, Palestine's place in it, districts, receiving, you know, public records requests, teachers for their ethnic studies curriculum, and really what they're looking for, and the inclusion of, you know, whether Palestine or Israel or Gaza was taught in it. It's ongoing. It is everywhere kind of here, both in Northern and Southern, you know, California. And then in terms of, you know, teacher unions, like we have had teacher unions who, you know, Oakland, they did kind of Palestine teach-in. Their district tried to warn teachers, but their union really, you know, hung strong and supported teachers in doing that. Different districts roll different ways. Some unions, you know, have more membership and, you know, are stronger than others on the topic. But I see this as something that's not going to end, and it's going to continue to be, you know, a battle with fierce pushback around the inclusion in the teaching of Palestine.
You know, some of the attacks, Jan, have been so disingenuous, you know, and Sammy was on this panel that we sponsored at the Northwest Teaching for Social Justice Conference. So it's a conference that involves hundreds of teachers every year, bounces back and forth between Portland and Seattle. We had, out of like 49, I think it was, workshops, we had three that had Palestine in the title. And we got the school, Chief Self High School in West Seattle, fielded over 200 complaints from people about the so-called anti-Semitic hate-filled conference that they were going to be sponsoring there. No one had the slightest bit of curiosity. They didn't come to us. They didn't say, what's going to happen in the workshops? It was just like they've turned the word Palestine into some kind of a slur. And, you know, that's, you know, one thing that we have to confront is just, you know, the Israel love it or leave it folks, they are going to try and suppress any kind of teaching about this. And that we just have to begin from that starting point.
How do you teach students about that part of it in terms of analysis of where pressure comes from in the schools and on teachers? Because there's both the material itself and holding this critical space, but then there's also how to help students analyze propaganda, media pressures, why it's not enough to just say, well, there are two sides here. We have to have dialogue on both sides of it. And how this repression in some ways can be exposed for a certain level of desperation around old narratives that are no longer holding. That may be a two-part question. I don't know, or a three-part. Samuel, what are your thoughts, particularly around how you teach students to analyze the world that they inhabit with the pressures around these topics?
I think, you know, really using critical media literacy as a tool and a strategy is very important, both specifically for this, but also for other things. We live in an age now that, you know, kids are glued to their phones. They get a lot of their information about the world, honestly, from TikTok, from Instagram, from social media, and allowing students or teaching them the tools, you know, to analyze the credibility of sources, you know, whether there is an agenda or political agenda, and really, like, what are the facts and getting to that. And I think also moving, you know, you mentioned about like the two sides. I try to teach kids there's not two sides. There are many, many sides in this, and a spectrum of kind of opinions and perspectives. And I think the facts, in terms of what's happening on the ground, I mean, I travel to Palestine almost every 2 years, get lost in the propaganda, in all the pressure, in all of the rhetoric. And so really going back to what are the sources teachers are using, making sure they're using good sources, and then teaching kids how do you critically analyze where the information is coming from, where is it being produced, because you can't really, I mean, that's one thing that kind of ignited young people around what's happening in Gaza and the genocide, is they were seeing it on their phone in lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, one thing too, Jan, is to start with history. So the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism is, you know, basically conflates anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. So let's take kids on an excursion back to early Zionism and the opponents of Zionism, because the Sephardic Jews of Jerusalem hated Zionism because they were, you know, they were ethnic cleansers, and the Sephardic Jews in Palestine were part of, you know, ecumenical communities with Muslims. The Jewish Bund, you know, the Jewish Bund in Europe, they were, you know, strongly anti-Zionist. You know, the New York Times was anti-Zionist. So there's a long tradition of anti-Zionism of people who are not being anti-Semitic. And so if you can look back on that history and then bring it forward and take a look at the claims of, you know, groups like the Anti-Defamation League that conflate anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, it just doesn't hold up.
Yeah. And, you know, Samia, you made this point earlier along these same lines that I don't know if I thought of in the same way, that the two sides idea, Palestinians on one side, pro-Israel on the other, collapses many differences, both the complexity and the history and the politics of Palestinian politics, but also it carries into the framing of a debate that somehow Jews are on one side. And of course, what you're saying, Bill, as well, is that there's this long history and a growing gap between younger Jewish Americans and their views of Israel.
Collapse of Israelism.
Yeah, right. Which is still has a lot of tread on its tires as a movie. So how are teachers responding to, maybe from your vantage point? And it seems like in the book, you provide materials that are very rich, interdisciplinary, and varied, and talk some about how important it is to not avoid topics like what is Zionism, the history, even you talked, I think, Sammy, about From the River to the Sea and how you've understood that phrase. How have you tried to prepare teachers, though, for these very anxiety-provoking attacks or threats on their credibility as teachers and on their scholarly work?
Well, I can start. So one thing is to see this as an organizing project. Don't just necessarily take this book and try and do it by yourself in the classroom. We're hoping to seed study groups around the book. We've got a study guide that we've produced to go along with the book, and we're encouraging people. We're going to send out applications soon for people to apply to form a study group. we've done this around the book Teaching for Black Lives and also Teacher Unions and Social Justice, that turning a book into an organizing project so that it's people collectively asking themselves, you know, how can we teach this? What experiences do we have? What pushback might we have? Who are our allies? And so beginning there.
So it's a kind of living, ongoing, dynamic project beyond the hard copy of the book itself.
And Sammy, you should maybe talk about the forums and things that you've done in the Bay Area that have a place for people to come together.
Yeah, I mean, last year, the Teach Palestine Project put on an all-day kind of teaching intensive. We had various workshops, some meant for novice, you know, teachers to the topic, some with experienced, everything in between. And it was very, very well attended. We're planning on actually doing one again next year, both here in California and maybe the Midwest. We've had more traffic on our Teach Palestine website than we've ever had before. It pushed us to kind of like revitalize what our site looks like and what's available. We're getting more inquiries for professional learning, for support. So we have meetings all the time with school districts, individual teachers, you know, families asking, how do we advocate for this being taught in our school? So I would say even with the pushback, the repression, and it being, you know, this is the repression on teaching Palestine has existed for a long time. It happened when I was in a, you know, classroom. It's nothing new. It is probably more intense and more deliberate and coming from all sides. But I feel like teachers are also, given the current political climate, asking themselves, in 10 or 20 years, am I going to be proud of what I did and where I stood and what I taught? Or am I going to be one of those kind of bystanders that said, oh, I'm so... So I feel like in a lot of the teachers I talk about, sometimes they just need some confidence building and to ask those questions like, if you're not ready, and I always tell teachers, if you're not ready to take this on and know this might come with it, I suggest you don't, because it can really wear you down, and make sure that you have people like at your sites that are going to be supportive. But I'm finding teachers really want to engage because they see, you know, teaching Palestine doesn't happen in isolation, right? There is, and there's lots of articles in the book around that solidarity, around the nexus of movements, around how this fits in with all other like anti-colonial, decolonial, equitable, social justice topic in education we want to see in our schools across the board.
So a lot of what you've mentioned perhaps is related to why so many students, young people, activists from different movements and backgrounds identify with the Justice for Palestine cause, which as a psychologist and activist myself has really interested me a lot, the identification with that struggle. Bill, do you want to say a bit about that before we close?
No, I mean, I think that that's a great point. You know, I think that we're sort of in the midst of a teach-in on Palestine now, a national teach-in. I mean, your film, The Palestine Exception, is part of that. Our book is part of that. And there's just so many more resources now to kind of go into the classroom and to do this work than there were, say, in 1989 when I was first starting to teach about this. And so there's so much more consciousness. And in some ways, I think this helps explain, you know, the crackdown now, that there is such a desperation of, you know, shut up about that. Shut up about that. Don't talk about Palestine, because there's so much more consciousness about it. And so, you know, I at the risk of shamelessly promoting the book, I encourage people to get this, because as Sammy was saying at the beginning, this book is not just for teachers. It's for, you know, just anybody who's curious about learning more about the issue. It's got poetry and personal narratives and all kinds of suggestions for other readings and films, and would be something just for a book group to take up too.
Yeah, and it's a very big classroom we're inhabiting right now. And for those of us who've always had that view of education, is something that partly happens in the streets as well as in the enclosed spaces of the classroom itself. And I did want to, perhaps Sammy, you can say a little bit about the fate of schools and students and teachers in Gaza and other, you know, the occupied West Bank, and there's been such a focus historically among Palestinians on education, high literacy rates under very difficult conditions. So there is both the inspiring side and just the unfolding, ongoing tragedy and grief that there. Can you just say a bit, and through your connections, perhaps, with what you're seeing of teachers and schools and students there?
Yeah, I mean, schools just reopened back in Gaza not too long ago. And it is, you know, and in the West Bank, the conditions, you know, of learning and getting your kid to school and being fearful, you know, I think about sometimes when my son has tried to be like, oh, I'm going to ride my bike to school. I'm like, absolutely, you're not going to ride your bike to school. It's too far. The lights. And I think about when parents send their kids right in the West Bank to school and are worried about, are they going to get there safely? And are they going to come home safely? Are they going to get there alive? Are they going to get... And at the same time, I see, unlike how we responded during the pandemic, where it was like, I mean, the whole world shut down, right? And everything, educate. And in Gaza, people were schooling in tents. People were schooling in the rubble. People were saying, I mean, Gaza has some of the highest education rates in like all of Palestine. They always produce the highest scores on like the exit, you know, exams that they give there. Even through it all, people are educating and living through and, you know, witnessing a genocide, surviving a genocide. That is an education, a life education in of itself that no one can describe. And, you know, I think as educators, when we have such a focus now in our country on wellness, student well-being, social emotional learning is, you know, I try to ask educators, like, think about, and we talk about trauma, think about the trauma, right? Just that and the impact on learning, on education and teachers. And still, I mean, I am awestruck, awe-inspired every day by the educators who have not given up, who show up to classrooms to educate Palestinian kids every day, because they know, right? That's their shot at life. That's their human right. I can't imagine, you know, what it's like. In those conditions, and still yet they're making it happen.
And people should not have to be that resilient, but nonetheless, it is so admirable and humbling, and it calls on us to do everything we can.
Absolutely.
For justice for Palestine. Well, I want to thank you for this wonderful book and all of the many contributors, and it's sure landing in an important place in time. And thank you both for being with me on the Olmo Variety Hour this morning. This is Jan Hocken talking with Samia Shoman and Bill Bigelow about their fabulous new book, Teaching Palestine: Lessons, Stories, Voices. And it's available through Rethinking Schools and probably can be purchased through the website. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
فيها عيونك الحلوات بتحب تشوف تعالي جنبي خلي راسك مرتاح بعيد عن الهموم غمضت عيوني رجعت للظلم العايش فيه الواقع اللي مربطني في الحركة والتفكير يا ريت لو كانت حياتي المسجونة في المراية ما بتردد بكسرها وبتروح كلها شظايا بس انكسرت فيها نور في المراية
That was the all-women's rap group Atija coming to you from the occupied West Bank. For that, you are listening to Jan Hocken talking with Bill Bigelow and Samia Shoman. This is Desiree Helligers, and I'm your host on this morning's Olmo Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Next up, we hear excerpts from a Municipal Eco-Resiliency Project-produced interview with Jahila and Leilani of Kasama Farm.
My name's Jahila. I use she and they pronouns.
Yeah, and I'm Leilani. I use they, them pronouns.
Kasama Farm, we're in our fourth season. We've got about
a little over a half acre in Hood River, about a quarter acre that we're stewarding in Gresham, and our little garlic plot here in Portland. Kasama is a Tagalog word. It is both a noun and a verb. As a verb, it means to be together. And as a noun, it has a lot of different meanings. It means comrade, it means companion, it means farm worker. Farming is also, for me at least, the political and revolutionary act. So I also think of it as like, Jahila is my comrade, Yololi is my comrade. Like anyone who's farming and trying to like disrupt the current way that people have access to land and food is, to me, is a Kasama, is a comrade. It really kind of started off as a project to bring together people from the Filipino diaspora to talk about like what is our relationship to land here. A lot of us have histories that are rooted in imperialism, and a lot of our stories have our families leaving our home countries, not necessarily because they wanted to, but more that they were forced to. So it can be weird missing someplace that's your home that you've never really been connected to, and also like living in a place that is your home that you also don't feel connected to. So I think we wanted to like create the project at first to just have a space to talk about these things and also to like grow food. Food is always a connector.
In our project, we are trying to specifically grow Filipino crops and Southeast Asian, East Asian cultural crops so that we can make the dishes that we grew up eating with the ingredients that often aren't accessible when you just go to Fred Meyer's or like the grocery store, when you go to Winko's. We'll grow like sitaw, like long beans, or ampalaya, bitter melon, these foods that are pretty nostalgic for people and essential for a lot of the dishes that our lolas cooked for us growing up. For me, it's really special to get to take care of those cultural crops and those plants that, you know, for generations people were growing and eating in the Philippines, and at the same time deepening my relationship to the land here, to Chinook land, and to learn how to be a tender of the soil here.
Yeah, we have a small CSA, so in addition to like growing the crops that we know that like the Filipino community enjoys, we always ask our CSA members if there's like a meaningful crop or like something that they're looking forward to eating, just like trying our hardest to source those things. It can be hard. Definitely sourcing seeds is a challenging thing, especially if they're culturally significant crops. Not all of them are easily available in the US. A lot of times it's like talking to people, asking if anyone has these seeds, if they can send them to us. We have seeds that we've collected from traveling to the Philippines and have brought back, and are working on like just making them adapted to the Pacific Northwest climate.
We started with an 8x8 greenhouse that we built in our driveway that we still use every year. And even though that's a small space and like very DIY, it's super nice to be able to have it be close to our home so that we can check on those plants every time that it gets cold out, or if it, like the sun peeks out and it gets really hot in there, we can turn a fan on. Last year, we also started renting land from the East Multnomah County Soil and Water Conservation District in Gresham at Headwaters Incubator Farm. There, they have a huge prop house, and so we have access to like that bigger growing space that's like has automatic fans, so we don't have to go in there. There's also 8 or 9 other farms that are growing on that site, and so we try to be in collaboration with them.
So we're part of Unity Farm, which is part of the Pathways to Farming program through the Oregon Food Bank. I think this is our third season in it. It's like a program for beginner BIPOC farmers. We get a little bit of financial support. We're technically off-site farmers, so the first 2 years that we were part of Pathways, we didn't farm here. There's a bunch of other farmers that do farm here, and this is their only access to land. Yeah, it's also nicer to be like in closer community with the other Pathways farmers. Yeah, it like breaks up the isolation big time. The Net Hood River, it's pretty bare bones. Like, we have the land, which is one of the hardest things to get as a farmer is land. So it's nice that we have land access there, and it's really beautiful soil, really healthy. One of the things that has really solidified like our connection to the community is the building of the Filipino Bayan Nihan Center, which is our community center, and just like having a centralized location where people of a specific ethnic identity can kind of meet and either use the space for their own events or activities or talk to the community center staff about immigration issues, about wiring money back home, like any number of things.
I grew up in Hood River, which is an agricultural community. So I've always been around farms, farm workers, and agricultural in general. So I feel like it was all around me, but I didn't know that it was going to be what I wanted to pursue. When I was in college, I was learning about environmental issues and food justice and things like that. But it was all like very much like in your head and like conversations and not really action. And after I graduated, I got a job on a farm, and that was the first time I was putting my hands in soil and spending a lot of time outside developing and deepening my relationships with plants and with land. And my mental health was really good that summer. And that was a huge change for me to realize that when I'm physically moving my body, when I'm deepening my relationships with land, that I actually felt better and felt really connected. And so it became something that I was pursuing, just always wanting to connect to local farms and be volunteering on other farms just for my own well-being and to know where my food was coming from. I was really inspired by a queer Asian-owned farm in Rhode Island called Movement Ground Farm. They were growing Asian vegetables and distributing to the Asian American community in Providence and Boston. And I was really able to see how the connection between growing those crops for those people was so powerful for folks. And it made me really want that for my community, for the Filipino American community too.
I got into landscaping while I was in college as like a summer job, and then like did that the first couple years after I graduated from college, and really enjoyed the work, really enjoyed being outside, and found a like urban farming internship in Boston. So I signed up and got to learn all about how to cultivate like plants, like food crops, in like row farming systems. I feel like I enjoy most parts of farming, like the planting, harvesting is always like the best, being out in the elements, like even it can be even enjoyable to be out in the rain or out in the snow.
I think one of the things I like the most about farming is how it marks the passage of time. And like when you notice, you know, in the spring, which plants, like which native plants are the ones that pop up, like when the chicory comes up, or when the grass starts to have pollen on it, or when it starts to like have seed heads, and just like these little markers that tell you what's going on in the world. Leilani was saying before, like it can be really isolating because you're, you know, alone in the field, or maybe just seeing like one or two people regularly, and you're so exhausted at the end of the day, you don't really have time to socialize. But then when you talk to other farmers, their experiences are so relatable, and I feel like other farmers are just observing so closely the world around them, the plants, the change in the weather, and it's so fun to talk to them and really nerd out about bugs or soil or weather. So I really enjoy that part, and I think especially when we get to talk with other Asian American farmers, Filipino farmers, and BIPOC farmers, just hearing about like their specific experiences is really validating.
People are always down to help out or share materials or seeds or just like growing information, and it doesn't feel as like aggressively competitive as like other workplaces seem. So yeah, I really appreciate that. It really seems like the community of farmers like wants you to succeed.
I think it's important for people to be involved in urban farming so that we all can learn where our food comes from and understand that it's really hard to grow food. Even if you're, you know, tending one pot and growing a tomato plant, you can understand that there's a lot of like squirrels, pests that are trying to eat your plant. You have to water it every day and be really consistent. I think that it connects you to your food and to the world we live in, but it also shows you just how challenging it is to be a farmer. And I think can make you in better solidarity with farm workers. We really have to be taking care of the people who are growing food for us, and the way that farmers and farm workers are treated in this country is really tough conditions, and sometimes it can be really despicable. Our foundations are really evil, and the current systems are built on top of those foundations. And so I think for people in urban areas to know that those systems are still in place and are serving us in urban areas to provide us food is really important.
There's a lot of really awesome projects happening in this city and in the metro area. You know, there's Black Futures Farm, there's Black and Brown Herbal Exchange, Flying Dog Heart, like all of the people here who are farming. Some other of our favorite farms, Another Spring Farm, Scrapberry Farms, Tanager Farm, Sun Moon Fields, Lomita Farm, Mora Mora Farm.
Oh, there's so many.
Peachwood Orchards, Anahuac Farm, Compo Collective.
It's a movement.
It's a movement, yeah. There's a lot of, like, the fact that I can name, like, more than 10 BIPOC-owned farms in this area is pretty, to me, seems pretty impressive. I wish there was actually a centralized location where all of these awesome farm projects in the Portland metro area, like, existed on a page so that, like, we could, like, all have our information on there and all have our asks, because it doesn't exist. And so, like, my advice is, like, to follow all of the accounts and, like, get on the newsletters of all these amazing farms that exist in the area. A lot of us have volunteer opportunities. A lot of folks still right now are looking to get their CSAs filled. You could go to the Come Through farmers market, a Black and Indigenous farmers market.
I feel like there's ways that you can get involved by, you know, showing up for farms, but also just getting involved in organizations. The food justice movement also includes, you know, the people who are tending to native habitats, native plant habitats along the Columbia River and the Willamette River. It also includes pantries and making sure that food is getting from our farms to people, to people's homes, and that it's accessible, that it's multilingual. If you're not someone who's going to be out in the field with the farmers or don't have, like, the financial privilege to be able to, like, buy into some of these farms, there's also ways to show up. One of the ways that we're part of the movement of BIPOC farmers is by being in community with people. So, like Leilani was mentioning, inviting other farmers out to our space and collaborating with them on that land, or sharing information, brainstorming to try to figure out how other farmers can realize their dreams.
In addition to, like, stewarding the land, I think one of the special things is that we're also bringing, like, our culture into this work and just, like, sharing a lot about, like, who we are as people and these identities that we hold, which I think is very different than how traditional farming in the U.S. has been for probably decades, if not centuries. Definitely when I was a kid and I thought of farmers, I just thought of, like, older white guys that sat on tractors all day and didn't really realize that, like, a lot of women actually farm. Like, globally, a lot of the agricultural folks are women. A lot of the movement, I feel like, starts in the urban areas where people get politicized around, like, farming and land access. And then I think where dreams can be further realized is, like, connecting the urban people and urban folks who want to be growing with land access in rural areas. I really want to get more people out into rural spaces from the city. And also I acknowledge that rural spaces, at least in this country and especially in Oregon, are, like, can be very violent and oppressive. And so I feel like we're in a unique position where we can sort of, like, create a space where people can come out and farm and not have to be, like, hassled by like a racist landowner.
I'd also just say that we're in a big transition of farming in our country, because the average age of farmers is farm owners is creeping up towards retirement. It's already in, I think, 62 years old maybe. There's a massive shift that's going to happen as other people need to start stewarding all of that farmland. My hope and dream is that that could be a new wave of farmers that care about sustainability, that care about soil health, who care about equitable access for poor folks, for Black and Brown folks, for Indigenous folks, that we can really see some land back efforts. And my fear is that large international corporations will buy that land and continue to degrade the soil and exploit the farm workers.
A lot of beginning farmers are like kind of mid-career farmers to make their businesses sustainable. Most people that I know that are POC farmers in this area, if not all, are not coming from generational wealth. And so like a lot of people are struggling with just like simple land access. You know, I feel like if you want to be a farmer, the first thing that you need is land. You need somewhere to grow. I do recognize that Oregon has more resources than other states to support small farmers. Which is why I think you're seeing a lot more of these smaller BIPOC-owned farm projects and farm businesses popping up here.
Seed planted but grew up in the conditions where hard environments fed us but no nutrition now. Check it better with what I wrote down. Feeding the soil hoping to grow now. From the youth, we ain't had a truth. Disconnected from the roots, we ain't had a proof. It consumed every part of the food we grew now. Just because they wanna profit off you. In every hood, it isn't good. They'd rather feed in the addiction than feed us all with the cure. Rather be selling the prescription division. Wishing the mission division isn't the ripple. We gotta be coming together by building neck of resiliency. Earth holding the lessons of ancestors. We fight while these bones go to two. While my customers at the bottom saying sugo.
Good morning, that was Roots featuring Wazla, Mike Crenshaw, Tony Hill, and Talilo. And that song was produced by the Municipal Eco Resiliency Project, or MERP. And before that, you were listening to a MERP produced interview with Jalila and Leilani of Kasama Farm. Next up, Fran Michelle and What's Cuckoo? Maha and the Fiction of Gretchen Felker Martin.
I'm a little late to this news, but back in summer 2024, news outlets began reporting that RFK Jr. advocated creating wellness farms, where those struggling with addiction could be healed by being in communities, growing organic food, and avoiding screen time. Now, on the face of it, that doesn't sound entirely bad. Like so much of the Make America Healthy wellness grift, it overlaps with some ideas that are reasonable and even popular on the left. Lots of people recognize the psychological benefits one can feel from gardening. Lots of people think organic food is better for the health of people and planet. Lots would agree that most Americans could use more community and less screen time. So, putting aside for the moment the larger context of the assault on public goods, Kennedy's wacky record, and the fact that drug rehab farms have been tried in the U.S. and failed, because apparently methadone works better in keeping people off opioids, putting all that aside, one can see the potential appeal. But, of course, one can't really put all that aside, and the coercive elements of RFK Jr.'s plan would undermine any possible benefits of the experience, making it punitive and dangerous. One of his models for such farms is Italy's San Patrigiano, known for physical violence as well as psychological abuse. Even if people have a choice, will it be the kind of choice given to houseless people? Would you prefer to go to a mass shelter or a jail, wellness farm or prison? Moreover, as others have noted, Kennedy has explicitly argued that Black kids need to get reparented in a rural area where they're denied most contact with family and friends, and treating Black youth by making them go do unpaid agricultural work isn't exactly subtle as far as racist fantasies go. But there are more candidates for these re-education camps, too. Kennedy has suggested they would be not just for people addicted to illegal drugs or opioids, but also places for people with ADHD or depression to get off Adderall or antidepressants. There's a lot to say about psychological medications. Their use is often contentious, their mechanisms unclear, their discontinuation difficult or dangerous, their profits for big pharma huge. But just as vaccines and pasteurization have saved millions of lives, so too have psychotropic medications proved tremendously helpful for many people. And does this plan stop at benzodiazepines and SSRIs? What about other chemicals that people take on an ongoing basis? What about those nicotine pouches that Kennedy kept stuffing in his lip during questioning by the Senate? What about insulin? What about hormones? Ah, yes, well. Anyway, when I first heard about this idea of wellness farms that he says would reparent people with addictions, when I heard that the Secretary of Health and Human Services likes the idea of re-education camps, I thought of Gretchen Felker Martin's 2024 novel, Cuckoo. It opens in the 1990s. Parents worried about their child's nonconformist behavior decide to send them to Camp Resolution, a desert ranch in Utah, where the kids can be taught hard work and Christian values and sent home cured of their wickedness. It's a horror novel, of course. The early 1990s really did see the burgeoning of residential programs for teenagers. Variously called wilderness therapy programs, boot camps, academies, these programs promised parents that they would address their child's addictions or mental illness or disobedience or queerness or whatever. In 2007, the Government Accountability Office released a report investigating residential treatment programs for teenagers in the U.S. from 1990 to 2007 and found thousands of reports of abuse and deaths in these places. In Cuckoo, the queer and trans and gender nonconforming teens are confronted with the smiling Pastor Eddie and his family, who turn out to be mostly taken over by some alien interdimensional monstrosity, like something out of Invasion of the Body Snatchers or The Thing. The mechanics of it all are left somewhat vague. The grotesque body horror, though, is definitely graphic, as are the sex scenes among the campers. You know how you feel about raunch and gore and whether you can stomach descriptions in which, for instance, someone's face opened up like a flower, splitting into fleshy petals lined with jumbled baby teeth and dripping thick, opaque secretions. Neither horror nor erotica is usually among my preferred genres, but I was held by the compelling vision, the gripping plot of rebellions both successful and tragic, and the diverse and complex characters. By the end of the story in the 21st century, the alien thing has absorbed not only large swathes of conventional society, including cops and legislators, but also others, and we're left with uncertainty, to never know, even in a lover's arms, who is us and who is them. Felker Martin's 2022 novel, Manhunt, is often described as very different. Its characters are adults, its genre more dystopia than horror. But it shares with Cuckoo both the penchant for raunch and gore and the centering of diverse, appealing, and flawed trans and queer characters, along with a plot rich in tension and thrills. There's no re-education camp in Manhunt, though there is a concern with getting hold of life-saving hormones. In Manhunt, the world has been changed since T-Day, when, as one reviewer summarizes, the estrophagia T-Rex virus has spread rapidly across the globe, turning anyone with enough testosterone in their blood into flesh-hungry rape machines with ripped skin that oozes pus under the pressure of expanding muscle, scar tissue, and subcutaneous tumors. It's clarifying in some ways, as one character thinks, at least he won't try to make me feel bad before he kills me. And there's no more wondering whether that guy wants to attack you, because he definitely does. But if you're a trans woman, so do the TERFs. Trans-exclusionary radical feminists are at war not only with the no-longer-human males, but also with trans women, whom they see as vectors, because they rely on testosterone-blocking and estrogen-enhancing homebrews to keep from turning into those tumorous feral zombies. Of course, the dangers are not as simple as the TERF perspective pretends. There's a rumor, for instance, that J.K. Rowling was killed in her bunker by a girlfriend with polycystic ovarian syndrome, which causes spikes in testosterone among people with ovaries. Despite the occasional bitter humor, these are gruesome books for gruesome times. But they're also portraits of queer communities of resistance and love, with fat, disabled, BIPOC heroines who see, or learn to see, through the false promises that you can find safety by hiding away from those others, or that these people really want to help you. As with those profitable and lethal teen boot camps, the MAHA movement is not going to make anyone healthy, though it might make some people even richer at the expense of the rest of us. I don't mean to suggest the government is ready to haul off to camps all the suburban white people on antidepressants, but the wellness camp idea can give the carceral state another lever over the 25% of the U.S. adult population currently taking a prescription drug for mental health reasons. It can offer the for-profit prison industry another revenue stream. It adds to the long turn from social to individual framings of health, from scientific to moral models of illness, from collective care to scapegoating of others. The Maha devaluing of anyone deemed to fall short of a fantasy of perfect wellness is part of the intensifying health fascism and necrosecurity that's been growing since early in the SARS-2 pandemic. In a world where the ruling class is eviscerating Medicaid and food stamps and scientific research and environmental protections and so much more, fictions that include more literal corporeal eviscerations can help us channel and organize our sense of horror at the ongoing apocalypse, remind us that we're not alone, and remind us that we can find each other. You might find Manhunt and Cuckoo at that socialist institution, the public library.
Was Kill the Poor by the Dead Kennedys, and before that you were listening to What's Cuckoo, Fran Michel on Maha and the Fiction of Gretchen Felker Martin. This is Desiree Helgers, and I've been your host for today's OMO Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That's it for today's show. Many thanks to Jan Hocken and her guests Bill Bigelow and Samia Shoman for their segment on Teaching Palestine, and thanks also to the Municipal Eco Resiliency Project, to Tim Rice, Yolotle X, and Juan Villa de Sola for their interview with Jalila and Leilani of Kasama Farm. The interview is part of MERP's Food Sovereignty Media series and was made possible by a grant from the Mount Hood Cable Regulatory Commission. When we post the show, we'll post the complete interview, and please do like it and subscribe. And finally, thanks to Fran Michel for their segment What's Cuckoo and for their technical support behind the scenes. I'm going to play out today's show with more of the MERP-produced song Roots, featuring Wazla, Mike Crenshaw, Tony Hill, and Jalila.
Drums of war in this field. Dirty hands they can heal. Fertile soil feeds your soul. If you stand, you can grow.
Make pass through your lips, the water, the juice, or the booze that you sip. Who you kiss, holy scripts, the words that we whisper, the jewels that you spit. Think about what you put in your mouth. Does it build you up, or is it breaking you down? What about the words that come out? What is meant, the intent of you making a sound? Mama, the porridge to strengthen and nourish. We forge in the forest from birth till we flourish. Put in the time and the earth will provide. We harvest the garden, no one should be starving. Seed to the leaves, to the tree we align. The food that we eat feeds our hearts and our minds. Freedom to lead, leaving no one behind. From the root to the fruit, with the truth intertwined.
Since the seed, they've been poisoning our seedlings, making us believe it's real food that we're eating. Profit off the poison, DNA is destroyed, and they wonder why we're sick, it's a result of their ploy. You will not mask my genetic memories. Won't clean our hands of our ancestor ceremonies. My dirty hands hit with rhythm and harmonies. Follow me wholeheartedly, believe this eternally. Sons and daughters learn to honor this medicine. We do not need what the pharmacy's peddling. Tradition dwindling, it's our chance to rekindle it. Plant the seed, nurture, water, and live with it. Care for our mother as she does us. Everything we need is provided with no cost. Giving it up to my muck, looks to fight for us. Nanook, Gossamox, under the sun.
Drums of war in this field.